It'll all go on if we're here on that old care.
Oh, what a time, what a warm and wondrous time. So sweet a shining moment in the sun. Oh, what a time, was there ever such a time? Then suddenly it's done, the moment passes. Where does the time go? Must we let it end? Where does the time go? Gone too soon, my friend. And where go the echoes of our lives?
The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for a public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Not the same as last week. Nope. Always something new and different here. The Journal is local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. Thanks for listening to us today. My name is Jay Koronik, and I'm here in the studio with our WHFR News Director, Dennis Reimer. So it's getting exciting outside. Right, Dennis?
It's getting, yeah. I'm curious what you mean by that.
Well, the big-time election. Some people only vote every 4 years, and this is the time, next Tuesday, November the 6th.
Okay, you weren't talking about the weather. You weren't talking about Hurricane Sandy or anything like that,
well,
right?
Well, I was indicating. I wanted to see which one you would choose as
Boy.
The most exciting.
So I went for the middle, none.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, no. And you
obviously,
know,
our sympathies and
sure.
and you know, all of our support, either emotional or prayer-related or maybe even financial, goes
sure.
out to the people on the Eastern Seaboard. I heard an interesting interview by Craig Folley today on his show on WDET. He had an expert that said, you know, I've been trying to tell people for years, don't live in these places.
Yeah.
Don't build right next to the big Atlantic Ocean.
That's right.
And, you know, an awful lot of hurricanes, especially in recent years, more than ever, do wind up in the New York City area or along the coast there, north from Virginia, Maryland, up sometimes hitting Boston instead of New York. But, in fact, I was there in the 90s. We had 4 days of rain in New York City. It didn't technically flood. There was no, like, waves from the ocean. But each day, because I was going to a conference, when I went outside, it was raining and blowing so much, I was always like soaked up to the knees.
Absolutely.
So
well, I don't know if you know this, but I lived in the New York City area
mm-hmm.
for almost 2 years when I was very young, like when I was 20, 21 years old. And the point is that I spent a lot of time exploring Long Island. And do you know on the Southamptons, mm-hmm. or the Hamptons, which are on the South Shore, right on the ocean there, a lot of these houses are built on stilts. And in good weather, it's wonderful. But then you see... most of those are probably gone right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when there's a 15 to 30 foot high wave coming in, that the force of that, whether it's 60 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, because it's being pushed by the winds, you say, well, that's just water. Yeah, but how heavy is water? Is it lifting a gallon jug of water recently?
That's 9 gallons, or 9 pounds is a gallon.
9 pounds, right. And you've got all that poundage of a tidal wave of water, and it's called kinetic energy, folks. When it's pushed by the wind, it's even more destructive. It doesn't trickle down. It hits you all at once, and not just 1 gallon, but tens of thousands of gallons. And so it'll wipe these structures right off the face of the beach. And it's just like I was saying, and no disrespect to the wonderful, indomitable human spirit, we're going to rebuild. That's Chris Christie and others. We're going to rebuild. Sure. We're going to make it. You really shouldn't, you know. the weather is changing. Maybe it's only temporary for the next 100 or 200 or 1,000 or 10,000 years, but you really shouldn't rebuild there. I mean, some people say, well, I knew New Orleans was at sea level, but I didn't know. Yeah, any place that's a beach and the water is right there, that's sea level, folks, okay, especially to the Atlantic. And you don't want to invest a lot of money, or you know, people talk about, well, I want to build a place for my grandchildren.
Right.
Well, you don't want to build it there.
No.
You
know? We met somebody in the know down in the Hamptons, and they said, that's where Alan Alda's summer home is. It's a, it's worth, you know, $12.2 million or whatever it is.
Alan Alda, the former star of MASH,
exactly,
on TV. Yes.
And the gentleman we spoke with said, well, it's on stilts because of erosion. It erodes, yeah, you think? It was literally on the ocean.
And with enough erosion, I mean, they showed the Weather Channel, I know, was showing some whole areas of beach that it was like a 30 feet tall section of the beach is gone because the wind didn't just blow the sand. In some cases it did. It blew the sand further in, like covering roads and so on. But in this section, New Jersey, it was like coming sideways. And so it just tore away 30 foot deep of sand and moved it on down somewhere. And so this house is sitting right on the edge of a 30-foot cliff, in effect, part of the, because the beach was just, the sand was just ripped right away. So the power of nature, you know, is such that we need to respect it. And I made a joke years ago about after the Katrina disaster is, you know, we have vacant property and lots in Detroit. Just move all those people who are homeless out of New Orleans, and we can have New Orleans North, you know,
yeah.
or New Orleans.
Oh,
and, you know, bring the music. Because Detroit, thank goodness, we're about, 1,200 feet above sea level.
Yes, we are.
I mean, I know the Detroit River is there, but we're not immediately in danger of flooding because of the distance to the coast, but also because it's a lake, for Pete's sake. It's not the ocean.
Right.
And so, you know, and it's crazy because the city of Detroit has dropped down to less than 1 million people, 700,000, mm-hmm. 800,000 people. We have whole neighborhoods and districts. How much would it cost to raise all those and relocate all those people up here? I know they miss out. I mean, they could bring the voodoo with them if they want, well as the music.
They could
have unique, you know, and talk about prosperous community. They could do a Mardi Gras parade here. I know that's their homeland, but their homeland is going to be underwater.
Right.
You got to make the break at some point and make the right decision for the future years. With this whole question comes up, of course, in politics, like who or what are you going to vote for?
Nice segue.
You're planning for the future. Right now, coming up, very important, we promised you this, and here it is. We have a 30-minute interview we had to pre-record about an hour or so ago with Scotty Bowman. This is Scotty Bowman, Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate from Michigan. That's mm-hmm. right, his Democratic challenger is Debbie Stabenow, and Republican challenger is Pete Hoekstra. And Scotty Bowman is right there on the ballot, along with, I think, a Green Party and maybe some other party's candidate.
Sure.
But because we deal with challengers and third-party candidates here on this show, because who else does? And they're very intelligent, very smart, and they got some great ideas. You don't have to believe or accept all of them. I don't accept all the ideas from the Democrats or Republicans either. So please take a listen to this. This will be the next 30 minutes. This is our interview recorded just earlier this morning on November 2nd, 2012. Scotty Bowman for U.S. Senate from Michigan. We're here in the studio today. It is November the 2nd. 2012, and we have a special guest in the studio running for U.S. Senate from Michigan, Scotty Bowman. And we're very happy to welcome you, Mr. Bowman, for office. We would like you to explain, since you are the Libertarian Party candidate for U.S. Senate from Michigan, please tell our listeners who may not be aware about the Libertarian Party and its basic platform.
Okay, well, the Libertarian Party, to sum it up real simply, is for more liberty and less government in essentially all areas of human life. And that means essentially less force and more personal responsibility. The Libertarian Party as an organization was founded in 71, but the first election it was involved in was 72. Partially in a reaction to the failure of the Republican Party to provide such a platform. Many people were upset, Barry Goldwater supporters, that were, much like many of the Ron Paul people, are disappointed today with the way they've been treated by the establishment. Many of the Goldwater supporters felt the same way. And then a little later on, when it got closer to the time when our party was founded, Richard Nixon imposed price controls. That's where a lot of the Republicans actually said, okay, that's it, we've had it. Meanwhile, there was, in parallel, other things happening. There was the hippie movement, and there's a branch of that group, especially anti-war activists, marijuana activists, anti-draft people, who also felt that government was invasive in their lives and they'd be better off with a lot less of it. There was also another faction, again, involved in the formation of the party, and those were objectivists, people heavily influenced by the philosophy and writings of Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting that you can't really, from what you said, the Libertarian Party almost sounds like the Tea Party people, but there's a difference there. Can you sort of explain what the difference is as you see it? First of all, I have to say, from my knowledge, the Tea Party is not a consistent group at all. It is an identifying label, but there's a lot of differences among beliefs of individual people that might associate or call themselves a Tea Party supporter.
Yeah, there is a lot of confusion bred by, I think, the manner in which people refer to the Tea Party movement. And when I refer to it, I refer to it as the Tea Party movement or refer to Tea Party groups. Mm-hmm. Because essentially it's an umbrella description of independent people who, what they have in common is a dislike for taxation and a desire to return to the principles of the founding fathers. That's what they have in common. And sometimes I even capitalized all the letters in T as an acronym for taxed enough already, but also, of course, the name hearkening back to the Boston Tea Party and the protests of the American revolutionaries. So that's something they all have in common. Beyond that, every group has its own particular character because there's different people in it. And some of those people have views that are somewhat anti-libertarian when it comes to personal behavior, but other groups are very libertarian in personal behavior. Most of them take no position on what they see as social wedge issues and mm-hmm. focus on the economic issues, in which case them and the libertarians are very much in agreement.
And it's kind of interesting, you can't necessarily lump, in my reading, you can't lump the Libertarian Party into strictly being a conservative or even arch-conservative or right-wing party because, as you mentioned, some of the social issues are actually in agreement with some liberal progressives, such as, human rights. Like abortion stance, legalization of marijuana, ending the so-called drug war that hasn't worked too well, also ending all foreign wars that don't make sense. That seems to be sort of a liberal progressive stance, and that seems to be sort of a mainstream Libertarian Party platform too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and because of the way in which, again, and this has something to do with the way civics classes are taught, and which, of course, the funding and the curriculum of the public schools is largely determined by people in the major parties, and so it's going to favor their paradigm. The left-right paradigm doesn't really fit what the Libertarian Party is. The late one of the founding members of the Libertarian Party, the late David Nolan, who I had the pleasure of meeting on multiple occasions, developed a chart, which is a much better description of the, instead of a political spectrum, it becomes a political region. And what we have then is the idea that you, effectively it's a graph, and you have one axis describing personal liberty, the other economic liberty, and libertarians are maximum on both properties of how one wishes to categorize liberties. And the left and the right are actually the inconsistent ones, the mixed ones, in the sense that they each have their own bit of statism and libertarianism, in the sense of advocating government intervention heavily in some areas of life, but not wanting it in other areas of life. So in a sense, we are the consistent party. And to quote actually a Republican, Ronald Reagan, it's not a matter of left or right, but of up or down. Hmm. And in a sense, that is how the Nolan chart is often positioned. So in a sense, he said something before the Nolan chart existed that kind of fits.
I totally agree with you, because I see that you have to have a coherent political philosophy, and using the word liberty is, and all the things that run as a tangent from that is basically what the Libertarian Party is about. I've heard some people say, for example, that our founding fathers were at least libertarian small l in their beliefs and their practices, and that therefore the Constitution reflects, that is, the Constitution as they wrote it reflects a lot of libertarian beliefs. Again, maybe small l, not exactly what the Libertarian Party stands for. So people should read and discover about the Libertarian Party and understand it. You are, and you know, the Libertarian Party candidate for U.S. Senate on all the ballots here in Michigan. We're talking mm-hmm. to Scotty Bowman here at WHFR Studios today. Next Tuesday, that's the day to get out and vote, and you have choices other than Democrat and Republican. And if you don't understand what these people stand for, well, you haven't been listening to us anyway, because we've certainly tried here on this station to show you not only challenger points of view, but especially the so-called third parties. Libertarian Party is, in effect, in membership, the third largest political party in the United States. And have to ask you, and it's a shame, and in fact, I mentioned last week, it's the only time I've seen the Libertarian Party mentioned on the front page of the New York Times, and this was 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, where they mentioned that Gary Johnson and James Gray, the Libertarian Party candidates as selected in the National Convention for President and Vice President of the U.S., will not appear on the Michigan ballot. And their ballot status has been challenged in three or four other states, primarily by Republican parties in those states, legally challenged to get them off the ballot. First of all, why aren't they on the ballot in Michigan? If they're, the Libertarian Party exists in Michigan, you're on the ballot, many other Libertarian Party candidates. What happened here in Michigan?
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you and this program for actually providing fair coverage of this news. The fact that one had to look in the New York Times to find out what's happening in Michigan shows how completely biased most of the media is in this state. Here's the situation. The Libertarian Party of Michigan has always had a presidential candidate on the ballot ever since our party was founded. Mm-hmm. The reason we don't this time has to do with an obscure part of Michigan election law, and it is part of a Michigan election law called the sore loser law. However, I believe the application was inappropriate here. The sore loser law forbids a political party from nominating as their balloted candidate anyone who lost the primary in one of the other parties. Now, that was generally referring to, though it didn't explicitly state it, the implication and all prior interpretations of that law was that it referred to the general election primary in which candidates ran, and the general election, which was coming up. What we have here with the presidential primary was the selection of delegates. And in the general election, we're not electing a president, we're picking electors. So in neither case are we really dealing with the candidate there. So this is actually a different application of that law. Now, that being said, Gary Johnson asked not to be in the Republican primary. He had originally pursued it, and when that deadline was approaching to not be included, he requested not to. He did that before the deadline. However, the Secretary of State said, well, we need to have it in writing, so you had to submit these forms, and there was a whole bunch of back and forth. And by the time the form got there, it was literally the last minute. Mm-hmm. And so then his inclusion in the primary was hung on an argument about 3 minutes. The Secretary of State claiming the form got there 3 minutes late, according to their particular fax machine. Now, there's plenty of time to still not put him on the ballot, but the Secretary of State was quite dogged in putting him there, I think specifically so she could exclude him later. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And also, even if her interpretation of the law was correct, the manner in which she behaved was extremely partisan, because she kept stonewalling and sandbagging and not answering questions when we were trying to find out whether or not they would even allow Gary Johnson to be included later based upon the ambiguity of the law applying to presidential.
Now, I understand that that law was not applied. Was it 1990 when John Anderson decided to run as an independent? And I don't know, maybe Democrats and Republicans both felt that he would steal votes from both sides equally. They didn't actually apply it before. So, I mean, that's, you can't have a law that somebody doesn't apply. But certainly that's sometimes referred to crazily as a sore loser law. But we're the only state in the whole U.S. that feel that that's appropriate. And I think it's completely inappropriate, in fact. But we can see how Republican parties across the country, at least four or five states where there's been these huge legislative battles on other grounds than here in Michigan, to try to keep Gary Johnson and James Gray off the party ballot.
Yeah, and it got worse, because we did have another, what the court ruled in our case was, first of all, they said, well, if he wanted to be an independent, he could have gotten on that way, which, you know, was like no time to get the signatures. But that brought up an equal protection issue, because in a sense, they really were kind of then making an exception, but not one that would include libertarians. Then they we also had another candidate who we would have put on instead of Gary Johnson if Ruth Johnson would have simply given a straight answer. And that's why I'm saying, even if she's right about the law, mm-hmm. she's still wrong, because she was being partisan and deliberately trying to foil our attempts instead of being a neutral service, which the Secretary of State is supposed to be. Because we had another candidate, and his name was also Gary Johnson. He was from Texas, and he was a libertarian, but he was not a former governor. And we put out a press release about this, so there was no deception intended. It was just a way of expressing support for Gary Johnson, the governor, but we were telling everybody, no, we're not trying to pretend this is the same guy. Right. The judge in the case where he ruled against us on including Governor Johnson on the ballot said that any other candidate can be included, just not anyone who is in the Republican or Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. And so we said, okay, great. We'll have Gary E. Johnson on there of Texas. You know what? Ruth Johnson wouldn't do that either. And of course, you know, all her game playing was at the last minute. So courts kept going, oh, well, you brought this case too late. Well, the reason we brought it too late is we couldn't have done it sooner.
Well, let me say, too, that, well, first of all, there is a way to vote for Gary Johnson and James Gray. It's a write-in candidate, sort of independent, but that has been certified. Those votes will be counted in Michigan.
Yes.
But you have to go in and put Johnson Gray in that special blank, and there might be hassles with that. But
yeah.
So voting straight party libertarian won't include Johnson Gray.
That's correct. Yeah. And the way it would be written in is, at least if you write in Gary Johnson, it mm-hmm. should be clear enough. The preferred way, if you got a moment, is to write Gary Johnson and president, and then right under in that same space, and there's a space for write-ins on the presidential block. You darken in the oval next to it like you would any other name,
okay.
And then right underneath James P. Gray, G-R-A-Y.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Gary E. Johnson is not on any ballot for anything.
In Michigan.
That does happen to be Governor Johnson's middle initial, I think. But to avoid any confusion, I would just write Gary Johnson, because they'll use any excuse.
Yeah.
Then it's his Romney's people. And what I would say is, if you don't have time to write in Gary Johnson, don't reward Mitt Romney, because he's not for free and open elections. Vote for anyone but Mitt Romney.
I have to point out here that both the Libertarian Party and the Green Party candidates for president, Gary Johnson, Libertarian, Jill Stein for Green Party, those two parties are on the ballot in enough states that if people vote for them, they could technically win the presidency in the Electoral College. Now, of course, Electoral College is a whole separate issue. That's a strange political animal. But technically, you say, well, it's a completely wasted vote. No, not really, if enough people vote for these candidates. And yeah, you can't vote directly for Johnson and Gray in Michigan on the Libertarian ticket, but he could still win enough states if people vote for him. I'm just saying that, that technically, both of those are viable candidates for president.
Mathematically.
Mathematically, exactly. That's the word I wanted.
Sure.
Yeah.
And even as since he is a registered write-in, hypothetically, he could win all the electors in Michigan if people so decided to do it. At this point, I think maybe enough people have already voted as it was already the die cast that way.
Okay, but, let me ask you this, because I know about your background as a Libertarian candidate in Michigan, and we've spoken before as you're running for other elective offices. I'm going to let you give your own bio and background in just a second. But you ran in the Republican primary back in February. Tell us about why you made that choice. Now, I have to say, that's not unusual. Ron Paul ran for president on the Libertarian Party ticket, and back in the, was it 1988, okay. And then he decided to affiliate with the Republican Party in Texas, and he's been elected from that same district as a Republican up through now.
Yeah. And in fact, the reason that the sore loser law didn't apply to me was because I never was balloted into the Republican primary, and yet my name never got on there. Oh. So that's how I managed to do what I'm doing, or I would not be running right now. I'd be all
I
done.
I see. Okay. So it's not just on the presidential side. Yeah.
Right. And in fact, it would be properly applied if I had run in the U.S. Senate race in the primary to not permit me. Now, what I did do is I was seeking to get in that primary, and I did have a petitioning effort, and I was participating in the debates with all of the every other Republican candidate at one point or another I had debated with. Mm. And the reason I was doing that, it was in a way you kind of answered the question partially, was, well, one thing, I was inspired by Ron Paul and the fact that he had gotten a lot more traction when he ran as a Republican in the primary process than he did as a Libertarian in the general election. And so, you know, in a sense, he lost, but it was a victorious loss in the sense that he got the message out to a lot more people. And so that's what I sought to do there. And I still succeeded in doing that because even though I didn't actually get my name on the ballot in the Republican primary, I accomplished the other objectives along the way. So I kind of had my cake and eaten it too.
Okay. Well, here you are. You are the Libertarian Party candidate for the U.S. Senate in the election coming up next Tuesday. Tell our listeners, for those that are not already familiar with you, your background, your qualifications for the U.S. Senate, just we have about 10 minutes left.
Well, one thing that is critical in this election is that there's a number of things. But if you look at the major party candidates, they're the same on so many areas. Both support an interventionist foreign policy. They support the continuation of this Federal Reserve system that's bankrupting our country. They support, and here's a big one, indefinite detentions. And now we had, when I get in there, I'm going to be, one of the biggest things I want to do is reverse the detainee provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act, which Debbie Stabenow voted in favor of. And what it did is, otherwise the NDAA was a pretty much routine appropriations bill, but the part regarding indefinite detentions allows for the military, and under the president's instructions, not just this one, but any future president's instructions, to turn their guns inward on the American people, arrest people without trial, hold them indefinitely, and essentially is de facto martial law. This needs to be repealed immediately. It's gone in under the radar of most people's awareness, but if you look it up, it's real. And by the way, both as far as the presidential candidates go, both Barack Obama signed it into law. Mitt Romney said it's a good law. And Gary Johnson said he would like to see it repealed. So there is some differences here. That's one thing I would go after when I got into the Senate. That's a new issue.
It's interesting. Even the Green Party is for repealing that provision.
Yeah.
When I was raised in the 1950s, we were taught in the schools, public schools, mm-hmm. that what happened in Stalin's regime in Russia and Hitler in Germany in that same way. People taken out of their homes, kept without trial, thrown into prisons or jails or gulags or concentration camps. All those rights, you say, well, that wouldn't happen in America. The point is, it's legal right now to do that, for the government to do that. And even the president now, by executive order somehow, has said, oh, also, I can identify anybody that I think is a threat to the country and have them killed, even American citizens. Now, that only happened once, and it happened to an American citizen who wasn't in this country. But all very dangerous precedents. You don't want any future president, even if you trust the present president, to have such legal authority.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that the memory of the American people at large isn't so good because, yeah, the entire Cold War propaganda thing that we would hear was every single thing they said about the Soviet Union as to why we can't let them succeed, why America must win, why the Soviets must fail. Every single thing about them, I can't think of any exceptions, have been fully embraced by the United States government. The United States government has embraced everything evil about what the Soviet Union was.
Yeah, it makes you wonder about the consequences of 9/11, that maybe the terrorist won by actually getting us to subtract some liberty and freedoms from ourselves. You know, that's ironic, and it's certainly wrong, and hopefully that can be reversed. Let's take just a couple issues here. I'm going to give you time to summarize. We have about 8 minutes left in the time that you've been able to give us today. How do you stand on rights for women? That's come up for various U.S. Senate candidates. Republicans aren't doing too well, at least with some of the crazy statements they made about rape and women controlling their own bodies. Libertarian stance and yours, what would that be?
Well, I believe in individual rights and not rights for any specific group. So across the board, women, men, gay, straight, whatever religion you are, everybody is entitled to equal rights under the law. You're entitled to live for your own sake. You own your own life. No one should tell you what to do with your own life or your own property so long as you don't impinge on the rights of others.
Okay. What about the health care issue? Dearborn, for example, is a senior community. As a majority of people that live here are over the age of 50. A lot of people are dependent on Medicare and Social Security in that age group. Libertarian Party would rather see some other choices.
Yeah. First of all, I just kind of want to bring up a good way to resolve this matter was brought up by Ron Paul, which was that we should be giving the newer generations an opt-out and, of course, honoring 100% our promise to those who are already dependent on the system, who are already vested in it. The system itself is a fraud, but we need to make sure the victims of this fraud, the people that are already vested in the system, are taken care of properly, and that we find a way to keep that promise that the government has made. But beyond that, in the end, I think it ultimately must be phased out. My personal feeling is that we need to transfer these programs, even in the process of administering them to the people who are dependent, we need to transfer these programs to the states, because currently what we have is unconstitutional. There is no enumerated power giving the federal government the authority to do insurance, pensions, health care, any of that. None of that is constitutional. So in a sense, for every day that the federal government still has its fingers in this, it is in violation of the Constitution, in a sense acting out treason.
How do you deal with there's so many other issues in running for Senate, as you've been questioned by people in some of these debates across the state. Give us another issue that you'd take a strong stance on if you were elected to the U.S. Senate.
One thing we need to do is first have a full and comprehensive audit of the Federal Reserve System, and then it needs to be dismantled. We need to get rid of legal tender laws so that regardless of what happens with that system, people have a chance to use competing currencies if they so wish. And to do that, what we need to do is we got to stop the Federal Reserve System from printing money out of thin air, which they can do right now. And one thing that's critical this year is different than the past 100 years in the following way. What's coming up is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Federal Reserve System. It has to be renewed in order to remain in existence next year. So essentially all you need is to have enough senators to simply prevent a majority vote or enough to continue a filibuster to stop the renewal of the Federal Reserve System.
Okay. It's sort of a money question, and then I'll let you do a summary about why people should vote for you. Scott Bowman, running for U.S. Senate from Michigan on the Michigan ballots all across the whole state, folks, next Tuesday, November 6th. My question is federal taxation, the income tax. I thought it was interesting that Herman Cain, of all people, running for the Republican presidential ballot, that he was in favor after a phase-in of about 5 years. He started with that concept that most people didn't understand, the 999 thing. But in fact, that would lead to something that's generally, and we've had some people on the show here talk about it, the fair tax, which would do away with the IRS eventually and go to a so-called consumption tax along with prebate checks coming. Without going into all the details, how do you feel about the governmental taxation system, the federal government taxation system?
Well, I break from my favorite presidential candidate on this issue. I personally oppose the what he finally had to concede was a less unfair tax. Because essentially, going through the trouble of a constitutional amendment to simply remove one type of federal tax and replace it with another direct federal tax, I think is just a waste of time that essentially gets us six of one, half dozen of the other. Why even bother? What I would like to see, first of all, is less tax, period. But the way in which I'd like to transform our tax system is get rid of all federal direct taxes across the board. This would still require a constitutional amendment, but that's what we're talking about anyhow. Have a constitutional amendment eliminating all direct taxes, have a proportional tax to the states, and let the people in the states, the state legislatures, the elected officials in the state that the people choose, work out a taxation or other revenue, non-coercive system if possible, that will collect the money that's necessary to meet their obligation to the federal government. Now, what this does, not only does it provide flexibility, 50 laboratories of innovation in which to create a less offensive tax and possibly something uncoercive like contract insurance and user fees, but also it gives the states control so that the federal government can no longer manipulate states and get them to abdicate their 10th Amendment rights by dangling tax dollars on them. Now the states have the power. They can withhold the tax dollars from the Fed, so we've reversed it. And also, well, then what's to make them pay? Well, you could simply have them be penalized proportionally by representation in Congress to the degree that they don't meet their tax obligation.
That's a fascinating idea. I'm sorry we don't have more time today to go into that. You obviously are not a candidate in name only. You obviously have been part of the Libertarian Party for a good number of years, and you've thought about the issues. You've read extensively on libertarian tracks, and I commend you for running for office. It's not easy to run for any political office. Tell us now, I'm going to give you about a minute or so to sum up why people should vote for Scotty Bowman for U.S. Senate from Michigan.
Okay, well, one thing that is very different this time around is specifically because Gary Johnson is not on the ballot, I'm at the top of the ticket. There's two definitions of principal candidate in Michigan law. One of them has to do with getting something that's equivalent to major party status, meaning that we would be in the top tier of political parties with the Republicans and the Democrats. We'd be in the primary system and all of that. If I get more than 5% of the votes cast for Secretary of State in 2010, before Gary Johnson would have been the top of ticket candidate, he would have been the principal candidate, and people are less likely to take that chance with a presidential candidate than the senatorial candidate. So Ruth Johnson may have inadvertently thrown us a bone. So if enough people vote for Scotty Bowman, you'll have three parties participating in the next primary.
There you go. How can people find out more about your candidacy? I know Libertarian Party website nationally is lp.org.
And the Michigan one is mi.lp.org, and I am scottybowman.org. That's Scotty, BOMAN.org.
Okay, and that's Scotty's SCOTTY.
Yes.
On top of it. Well, thank you so much for being with us today on the WHFR Journal. Good luck in getting your message out to the people of Michigan.
Thank you.
And that was our interview of Scotty Bowman. And if you were listening closely, he is the Libertarian candidate for President of the United States. This is WHFR.FM, a station making waves.
Not of the United States. Of the Senate.
U.S. Senate.
For Michigan, yes.
In the United States. From Michigan.
Got it.
Yep. To the United States Senate. Okay. There we go. Yes. Yep. And we appreciate his time this morning. He actually needs a day job.
Don't we all?
Yes. And so we had to do it before our broadcast.
Passionate huh? man. Very mm-hmm. passionate.
Yeah. Tell your friends, too, that our interview last week with Sherry Hancock, the vice presidential candidate for United States vice president.
That's right.
We interviewed her for half an hour last week on this show. And remember, you can look at all of our podcasts and take your choice here, including our special show on the proposals. We did a review of all the proposals back in September. And if you go to our website, WHFR.FM, and you click on Talk Shows, and this show is the WHFR Journal. The shows that have a major guest, like last week, Sherry Hancock and others, besides the date, that'll also be the description there so you can make your choice. And the show on the proposals, where Dennis and I analyzed a variety of points of view on the six major statewide proposals, that one, I think it was September 24th, but whatever, it says, when you get to it on the website, it says proposals, state right. proposals. So you can find it quite easily. Tell your friends, spread the word. There's more than just Democrat and Republican. There's more points of view out there, and I think a lot of them are worthy. We're not endorsing any. We're not against any. But if you don't know all of the choices as well as possible, you can't make a very intelligent vote.
I want to just a shameless plug here while we're on the subject. Airing right now on Dearborn Heights, WDHT-TV, I hosted a show that went into really in-depth analysis regarding these statewide proposals. Mm-hmm. And one of the people we chose for our four-man panel was Jay Kordick. And so he's on there. Depending on what cable company you're with, Comcast, AT&T, or WOW, it's $10, $12, or $99 on WDHT cable TV channel in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. It's showing every day now, twice a day. And it's a very comprehensive, about 45 mm-hmm. minutes, very comprehensive. And Jay gave his opinion as well as a real good overview.
Actually, Kordick Unchained.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Well, it was totally unchained.
No, we won't go there.
I wouldn't
there.
Do that to you folks. But.
But it was a lot of fun. So check that out mm-hmm. if you're in Dearborn Heights.
And you know, the opinions expressed on this show, whether it be Scotty Bowman's or Dennis's and mine, are thanks to the generosity of the people that are here at Henry Ford Community College and should not be intended to be their opinions or ideas at all. And they certainly don't tell us what to say, and we appreciate that freedom, which is so rare in broadcasting. But we're trying to do a responsible job fitting our mission, which is to give you news and information that is not carried on the other channels in Detroit or in the other media, as much as possible, of course. But it is an opinion show, a commentary show, so sometimes we will bring up those stories and put our own spin on them, as
yes.
you know. Wanted to say about voting for next Tuesday, of course, our local clerk's office in Dearborn, I think all the clerks are recommending absentee voting. It's true that if you're not over the age of 60 or infirm, as they say, or slightly immobile, or currently just very sick, maybe came down with a cold or flu or something and not sure if you can get out of the house next Tuesday. I would say you're thinking of being out of town because you have to check off one of those boxes. You can't just go in and vote early in Michigan. I realized that when I was down in Texas 2 weeks ago, they were starting voting.
Right.
Because they did walk-in voting, and they had multiple polling places open, not all that they'll have open on November 6th in this area of Texas that I was in, but they had three or four in every community, and you can vote early. You know, you can do absentee ballot, of course, get one in the mail, send it back in the mail, but you can actually go and just vote. There's actually polling places open a month early in Texas, and I think that's a wonderful idea because giving people the opportunity to vote if they want to vote is an important thing. Well, here in Dearborn, qualified voters should consider absentee ballot. That means you have to be registered, and you have to fit one of those criteria to ask for an absentee ballot. But it's between you and the little boxes on the piece of paper you fill out. I, in my mind, although I'm of the appropriate age that I would qualify for an absentee ballot anyway, but I might be out of town, so I would say out of town.
Right.
You know, I expect to be out of town. I would hope I had money to go somewhere, but I usually don't. But I'm just saying my expectations, I think that's enough to qualify anyone under the age of 60 who's not infirm or ill or has a job that's 18 hours, you know, and they can't get there to the polling place between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. Of course, I'd like to see change in that. In Australia, where they get over 90% of the population showing up, no, they don't punish them, put them in jail if they don't vote. But the big deal is in Australia, and besides a sense of democracy and civic responsibility, it's on Sunday.
Oh, no excuse.
It's a national holiday.
Yeah.
So all businesses except essential services are supposed to close. And, of course, on Sunday here we have all the shopping malls open. But right. They expect all the businesses to close except for essential services. And so people, yeah, they go vote. It's a big party day. It's an election day. You go and you vote and people talk about it. And why does it have to be on a Tuesday? Now, I know the argument is to... Oh, if it's a Tuesday and it's a little bit difficult to vote, only the people that really are passionate about voting, that really maybe are intelligent and learn the facts and clearly know their mind, will show up. A lot of other people, and I saw in the news that 90 million people may not vote Tuesday, even though they could. And, of course, that just reflects the fact that 30% of the population probably won't vote. We never usually have more than about 70%. Usually it's only slightly more than 50%
right.
In any presidential election nationwide showing up to vote. And you say, well, it's just the people that know what they're doing. Yeah, I know a few people. I'm not going to vote. I don't know who's running. I don't know what the issues are. I don't know what I believe. I never read a paper. A really well-functioning democracy want people like that to vote for a name they think they recognize or at random?
It does more harm than good.
Flipping coins?
Right.
Right. That's not going to help democracy. Well, unfortunately, in the book by a major author, came out a few years ago, it's just been updated. It's called The Myth of the Rational Voter.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major political science document, and it does pull together what I even learned from several different sources when I took political science classes in college 40 years ago, 50 years ago now. Oh, my God.
Wow.
And that is that people, first of all, say one thing, you know, before they vote. And when they go in, it's sort of like a clean slate, and they vote for the craziest of reasons. And even exit polls doesn't accurately reflect. Often they're embarrassed to say voted for.
Exactly.
Of course, it is a private thing. I mean, you can vote for whoever you want to once you get in there. But at the last second, because of the emotion or, once every 4 years, wow, this is really different, they just get very emotional. They vote, if they're Irish, and no disrespect here, they might vote for somebody whose name seems to be Irish.
Right.
Because they might think it has something similar to them. Or a man might vote for a man rather than a woman if right. they don't know the difference, or vice versa. And
if they don't know the difference between a man and a woman, then they shouldn't be voting.
Even among the people that are voting, which in the presidential elections is never more than 70% of registered voters, the guess is by this person that over half of them vote for the craziest of reasons right. that have nothing to do with the issues or the quality of the candidate. There's really a disconnect. That's too bad. I don't know how we can explain it. All we know is democracy is the best of all the systems in the world, but it's also one of the worst. There's nothing better, but it's not good. We got to work real hard to maintain our democracy and our rights. And I think the first step is, yes, you need to vote. Yes, you need to be educated somewhat on what the issues are. You need to. I would suggest, and of course, Press and Guide and Times Herald will love me, that locally, you read the local papers. Now, the Press and Guide, I criticized them 2 months ago. Where's the interviews with the candidates? And so they've done the best job ever in stories on who the candidates are, although not direct interviews, but still background pieces, as well as their endorsements. And they, for the last six, including this week, six issues of the Press and Guide, 2 issues a week, they've been... kicking out the endorsements.
I agree.
So good to see them. They give a little bit of reason why. You don't have to agree. You shouldn't follow them blindly. But if you've been reading regularly, you kind of know what they're talking about and why, you know, you may want to further support or change your support for an office or candidate.
And I have to say, as far as just for pure objective information, I can't find a better source than the League of Women Voters. They put out this publication. It's absolutely free. We have them here all over campus, and mm-hmm. I've seen them all over Dearborn and Dearborn Heights.
Although I have to say, they don't have the latest information about who is on the ballot. Vote411.org, which is their national website,
right,
continues to say in Michigan that Gary Johnson and James Gray for the Libertarian Party are on the presidential ticket.
This is true.
They're not on the ticket. That was decided in early September. You should be able to update a website quickly, right?
Sure.
Nobody is doing that for the League of Women Voters. So there's some other offices and candidates. Like I just found out, and I could, because I already did my absentee ballot, that there was a candidate for president on the Michigan ballot from the Natural Law Party.
Really?
And I did my research because the question came up here on this show. Natural Law Party nationally has been Natural Law Party, the national political party, is disbanded. They went out of existence. They don't exist. 2004. After the 2004 election, they gave up. They decided a different approach to get their message out somehow. And I swear there's a candidate, and it says Natural Law Party on the Michigan ballot right now. Of course, with enough petitions, I think you can claim to be just about any party, whether it's a national party or not.
Right.
So maybe there was a Michigan component that's still alive and kicking for Natural Law.
Well, they did say that they went to refer any questions or concerns to the state offices. So maybe right. That is the case.
Right. Let me finish,
ahead,
Dennis,
sorry,
on the absentee ballot, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
Absentee ballots are available at the City of Dearborn. All the way through Saturday. This Saturday, they're open from 9 to 2, not the usual full day, but they're usually not even open on a Saturday. So the Dearborn City Clerk's Office at Town Hall, that is the old building at Michigan and Schaefer.
And Dearborn Heights as well.
Include
them in this.
Are they going to be open on Fridays, though?
No.
Because they're never open on Friday, but
Saturday,
they're going to open on Saturday.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yes.
Never on Friday, but Saturday this week,
give them credit,
for the sake of getting absentee ballot. Now, remember, you could go in and pick it up, but if you mail it back, then it may not get there by Tuesday. And
right.
I don't think, I'm not sure if they look at postmark or whatever. I would suggest going in, getting the ballot, stay in the office, make your ballot decisions right then, and hand it right back to them.
Yeah.
Now, you can bring it back to them even on next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, well, the clerk's office will be closed next Tuesday because of elections. No, for election issues, they're going to be open in Dearborn and maybe in Dearborn
and
Heights,
Dearborn
too,
Heights,
just to receive absentee ballots.
That's
so
exactly
you should
right.
physically take it in. It's this late. I don't think you should trust the U.S. mail. But if you got the time while you're picking it up in person, just do it right there
and
hand it back.
The city clerk has stated, Walter Prashevitz, he says, if you do decide at the last minute to actually go to the polls and vote, just take your absentee ballot and you can swap it out for a regular ballot. Not a problem.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point out, showing a government-issued ID, like a driver's license,
mm-hmm.
is encouraged to ensure accuracy. But voters who don't have their identification with them can still vote. They will be asked to sign a brief affidavit. That's no biggie deal,
nope,
okay?
Not at all.
So if you don't have a picture ID or anything with your name on it, driver's license, passport, whatever, don't worry about that, despite what other people may have suggested to you. And if you're in a precinct that has printed up, I don't think it's in Dearborn, this checkoff box indicating that you are a U.S. citizen, yes or no, check it off if you are. That's not really legal in Michigan. Even Governor Snyder said, you shouldn't do that. But Ruth Johnson,
mm-hmm.
married, mentioned prominently by Scotty Bowman, but not in a positive way, our Secretary of State, Republican Secretary of State, she's the one that came up with that. And she has, even though it was found to be unnecessary and I think technically illegal, she said, well, you can still put on the ballot. And so many individual cities have added it to the ballot. And again, you don't even have to check that off because you wouldn't be registered as a voter if you weren't a U.S. citizen in the first place.
That's a good point.
So it's just completely redundant. And don't be afraid. You say, well, I'm here on a green card or, I'm here on a student visa or something. If you qualify for registering in the first place, you're qualified to vote and you don't need any proof or evidence of that. They will check your name on the registered voter poll in that precinct. You have to be voting in the precinct
the
you're
right
registered
place, sure.
for, you know, and they'll look up your name there.
And they can find that at vote411.org. Also has the different precincts as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's a great resource. Vote411.org, but you have to put in your address. I'm just saying there's a few inaccuracies on the Michigan ballot. There,
right, no, I agree with that.
Like Gary Johnson's not there. So that's that. I wanted to turn, we have only about 6 or 7 minutes left, but obviously the election is a big deal. And, of course, what happens after the election will be a big deal. And next week we will have our WHFR Journal analysis. We'll give you the results of the local election. You'll probably already find out about the results of the national offices by next Friday.
Well, maybe people maybe shouldn't not. Wait. You know, just
if
don't
it's
listen.
It's like the year 2000. Where they go on 2-3 more months? We weren't sure.
Don't listen to the news at all, and you'll hear your information here first okay. on Friday.
Dearborn Farmers Market, we want to say farewell and sorry about this to Joan Reed. Joan was the person, the volunteer who started the Dearborn Farm Market under the Chamber of Commerce 5 years ago. She resigned from the job this last week due to disagreements between herself and chamber leadership. That'd be Jennifer Gearing.
She's part of them.
Yep. Over the future and direction of the market. Reed said her vision was a market that sold only Michigan-made goods from local vendors. And was a community gathering place. And so they have appointed a new person. Jennifer Gearing said that they are going to make some changes. And a Millie Judd is the new market manager. And we'll see what her ideas are. Maybe get her on the Journal sometime next spring to see where they're going with that. So
we spoke with Joan on a few occasions.
Yes, a few, and great that a volunteer would set this up and spend 5 years of her life. She was seriously ill for a month or so this last summer and wasn't actually actively out there. It's interesting. Her husband came out there to help manage while she was recovering. But I'm sorry that this had that twist of events there. A little bit of politics going on. I know I had my ideas for improving the market too, and I don't know. They weren't against her vision at all in terms of selling only Michigan-made goods from local vendors, but we'll see what they turn into. I hope they don't turn into a carnival and then a lot of commercial food companies come out with their stands.
No, the way it is now, I mean, if there's going to make any changes, I would say expand it for more local products.
You've heard this on the news now, and it's not fact-checking, folks, but, you know, I had to bring this up. This is a story about Mitt Romney. There's an editorial in the New York Times yesterday, their lead editorial. They say, oh, the Times, they don't like Romney. Yeah, but what they're talking here about his national comments, his nationally known comments that he has made, as well as his nationally run spots for his campaign that he gave permission to run. In which he said, and this came up because I was having, like, a few days ago, Chinese food in Garden City with my daughter, and, I don't know, the Chinese waiter happened to say, you know, I'm voting for Romney because he wants to send Jeep production to China. I said, where did he get that? And I guess I hadn't caught the fact.
He said Obama wanted to send.
No.
He said Romney.
I'm sorry, not Obama. Well, Obama... It is now criticized in the Romney ads as selling Chrysler to
China.
Fiat, Italy.
Or Italy, yeah.
So
right.
Italy, not Italy really, but the Fiat National International Corporation owns Chrysler. But in fact, the Romney ads on TV right now say that, you know, that company, that Italian-owned company, is going to send Jeep production. In other words, losing jobs in America.
Right.
There's a big Jeep plant in Toledo.
Right, that was
and
it.
Anyway, my Chinese waiter was very upset, and I didn't know how to respond. And so, well, it's been everywhere. That's totally a lie. There is no Jeep production that will be moved from the United States to China. That is the absolute fact, Jack, and that's a statement from Sergio Marchionne, who runs Fiat, head of Chrysler. He's Automobile Magazine's Man of the Year for automobiles. Chrysler has 80% surge in sales and profits. They're doing better in terms of that growth spurt than Ford or GM. Tremendously profitable because of the consolidation and the assistance of Fiat and keeping jobs in America. You know, in fact, 1,100 new jobs are going to be added in Toledo to produce a new generation of Jeep. Now, sure, they may actually build a factory in China and build some Jeeps there too, and of course that factory will have Chinese workers, but no jobs are leaving America. Fiat is doing a great thing here in properly managing Chrysler. I mean, it's a matter of good management, people that know cars and know what the market is, or bad management, which is Chrysler's had for the last 10 years since, well, Lee Iacocca left. Remember, Iacocca got the first federal grant to bail Chrysler out, which he paid back in about a year and a half,
right,
once they got back on their feet. A good manager knows how to maintain jobs, increase sales, but they have to have somebody who's a car guy, somebody that understands automobiles and why people buy them. So, Sergio, I agree with your being car guy of the year for what you've done for Chrysler. Thank you very much. And it's absolute lies. Now, Romney did say, let them go bankrupt. And, of course, that would have been the wrong thing. Bankruptcy would have taken 5-6 years. Millions of people have been out of work, not just in Detroit jobs, but also related jobs in the auto industry and related industries throughout the U.S. The bailout, which is paid off for Chrysler. I mean, Chrysler's paid the money back with interest to the U.S. government. So we're out of it again, just like the first bailout. And, of course, GM's not doing badly, although the U.S. government still owns, I think, 40%, 30% share in GM. But they'll make their money back from that investment, too. So, I can't believe the statements that Romney has authorized here. And this whole thing about Jeep production will be moved from the United States to China, lies. Damn lies and statistics turned against you. I forget who had that phrase. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. Might have been a book by some famous person, but this is just totally false. Jeep production is staying in the U.S. It's staying in Toledo, and there's going to be 1,100 more jobs because Jeeps are selling like hotcakes in the U.S. and around the world. And sure, they might have new plants elsewhere, like in China, but we're not losing any production.
You just said Jeeps are selling like fried rice, just for the to keep it. But no, my question is back
fried
to the
rice patties.
Well, so was your waiter in favor of Romney because he thought that the Jeep
Romney would keep Jeep production in the U.S. Right.
So that's I get it.
No,
now.
He actually said he's visited China. He still has relatives. He works at a Chinese restaurant. I assume he's a U.S. citizen, but
that's not important.
He's gone back several times, but he didn't want to see Jeep production moved. He was a patriot, American.
Yeah, oh, good. Okay, then you can go back there to eat.
And I got to fill him in on the fact. Sure. But I mean, a lot of people cover this. Even John Daly in Comedy Central show. John Stewart, yes, on his Daily Show and Comedy Central, and also Stephen Colbert on the. They've all mentioned these things. Of course, they're a satire show, but they said, "Look, this is false. It's totally false. How anti-Detroit and how many lies can you put up in your campaign?" And Republicans in Fox News have been going after fact checkers. Who are they? They're all liberals, those fact checkers.
Yeah.
They're all putting a spin on it.
Let's check the fact
checkers. No, the facts are the facts. There's no evidence anywhere in anything that Fiat or Chrysler has done that they're going to cut production in Toledo. And they announced this 1,100 more jobs in Toledo. That was announced months ago. Okay. I knew the plans from reading somewhere about the expansion of Jeep in Toledo in the U.S. months ago. It's just complete falsehoods, and that's why I guess I didn't catch it as early as my Chinese waiter, because I don't watch TV. These commercials are toxic, all of them.
That's true.
Are incomplete information. I don't care which side they are. You can't believe a soundbite, a 30-second spot.